Okay, let's begin where we left off yesterday. We were looking at question number one on mathematics questions and answers. We answered that one. Where does mathematics come from? The source of the structured order of in creation. The source is the Creator, the triune Creator revealed in Scripture that answers to the issue of unity and diversity. Let's look at question number two. And question number two is the question of applicability. Why does mathematics work? Now, when unbelieving scientists and mathematicians approach this question, the answers are quite intriguing and interesting. So here's the first one. I'm going to give you just a few quotes, and then we'll make some concluding remarks. This is again from Morris Klein. I've mentioned him several times, and this is from his book, Mathematics in the Physical World, in the introduction to the book. And he poses a few questions here. But where and what are the physical agents that produce the effects mathematics describes? There are no answers. Why does mathematics work? We are faced with a mystery. The study of mathematics and its contributions to the sciences exposes a deep question. Mathematics is man-made, so notice the starting point. Starting point is basically in the context of man-generated mathematics. Yet, with this product of his fallible mind, man has surveyed spaces too vast for his imagination to encompass. He has predicted and shown how to control radio waves, which none of our senses can perceive. And he has discovered particles too small to be seen with the most powerful microscope. Cold symbols and formulas completely at the disposition of man have enabled him to secure a portentous grip on the universe. Some explanation of this marvelous power is called for, and Klein cannot give it. He's only left with the question. He does answer it with the word mystery. Let's look at another quote from a mathematician by the name of Nicholas Bourbaki. He's really not a person. It's a collective pseudonym for a group of French mathematicians who were working in the 1950s. And they said this, that there is an intimate connection between experimental phenomena and mathematical structures seems to be fully confirmed in the most unexpected manner by the recent discoveries of contemporary physics. But we are completely ignorant as to the underlying reasons for this fact, and we shall perhaps always remain ignorant of them. Mathematics appears thus as a storehouse of abstract forms, and it so happens, without our knowing why, that certain aspects of empirical reality fit themselves into these forms as if through a kind of pre-adaptation. That's the result of the observation of these mathematicians. Of course, they have no answer for that fit. And one final, I'm going to give you a quote now from a Nobel Prize winner in physics, Eugene Wigner, and then I'll give you a final quote from Albert Einstein. Now, this is Wigner on why does mathematics work. The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there is no rational explanation for it. The use of, we talked about complex numbers yesterday, just briefly, square root negative one. The use of those numbers is in this case not a calculational trick of applied mathematics, he's talking about quantum mechanics, but comes close to being a necessity in the formulation of the laws of quantum mechanics. And there's one of the equations. Do you see I there someplace? This is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, wave equation, that governs the analysis of quantum mechanics, and our I is right there. Square root negative one. Partial derivatives, second partial derivatives, don't worry too much about everything else, but note, this is the governing equation behind quantum mechanics. And so Wigner looks at this, and I is a necessity for this to work, and so he's responding in amazement to that reality. And he says this in a conclusion, it is difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here. So there's three examples of many where mathematicians and scientists and physicists look at the applicability of mathematics to the physical world, and they have no answer for it. They resort to mystery, miracle. In the final quote, Albert Einstein said this: "The eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility." To Einstein, the fact that we can comprehend the world was a mystery because he had no rational basis for it. He worked on that assumption, we can comprehend the real world, we can use our mathematical models to predict and explain, but to justify it, he could not do it, because he was asked later why he made that statement by a friend. This before he died. Took a walk with Einstein. This is from a book that's published in French, so it's not published in the English language. This is reported. Einstein talked with his friend, and he said, "Well, you know, I have to say this. I have to say this statement, because if I don't say that, I will fall into the hands of priests." By that he meant I will have to admit that there is a creator God above and beyond me that has ordered the cosmos to reflect these patterns. He did not want to do that. So that's an illustration of suppression of truth in unrighteousness. So we can see that in conclusion, when a man rejects fundamental biblical truths, the doctrine of creation, he is left with the options of mystery and miracle. In other words, I do not know why mathematics works, and it is a miracle that it does. But what is the answer biblically? Well, we return to Colossians chapter 1, verse 17. Christ is before all things, and in him all things in the universe are a harmonious whole. There is a harmony. There is a resonance in the created order. Addition reflects the predictable way in which you can count objects. Without predictable order, it would be impossible to do any mathematics. What if 1 plus 1 equals 2 worked some of the time? Now, you might like that if you have a negative balance in your bank, but the bank wouldn't like that. All right? So you have these constraints that force the issue. And why learn your addition or multiplication tables if they are not consistent? Mathematics is consistent because God upholds all things in harmony in and through the person of Jesus Christ. Again, turning to Jeremiah 33, verse 25 through 26, the covenant of God is revealed in creation. If I have not established my covenant with day and night, remember Genesis, seed time and harvest, day and night, my promise, and the fixed laws of heaven and earth, including all the laws of mathematics that are undergirding all the laws that we men have developed in terms of the heavens and the earth, then I will reject the descendants of David and my servants. So the context of covenant, as Kuyper emphasized in his work, Christ is the mediator of redemption and creation. And as we do mathematics in the biblical Christian fashion, in the biblical Christian framework, our work should continually remind us of God's faithfulness to the word of his covenant in both redemption and in creation. Christ is the Lord, as Kepler cried over every square. As Kuyper cried over every square inch of creation. So this is reflective of the Kuyperian thrust. So mathematics works, in other words, 1 plus 1 equals 2, because the infinite, personal, living, and triune God holds all things in harmony in the person of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. The harmony between the physical creation and the human mind exists because of the doctrine of creation. Man can therefore think mathematically, and the physical creation reflects mathematical properties because God is the creator of both. Therefore, the doctrine of creation reconciles what is irreconcilable in when one's thinking is based upon man-centered starting points. So in summary, where does mathematics come from? Mathematics comes from God in Christ structuring the order of creation. And then why does mathematics work? Mathematics works because there is a resonance between the physical creation and the human mind because of a common creator. So that ends the questions and answers. And now what I want to do is explore another aspect of that creational harmony There are many, many options I could choose to go into. For example, many, many connections. I could have chosen the physics of motion, free fall, projectile motion, planetary orbits. We talked about that with Kepler. The physics of springs and heat. I could have chosen quadratic equations. Well, we're going to talk about those a little bit. We could talk about the poetry of theorems, the internal structure of thinking in terms of mathematics. We can talk about the way theorems have a meter and a rhyme behind them in their logic, the elegance and beauty of many, many mathematical proofs. For example, the Pythagorean theorem has 321 ways to it's been discovered. In fact, there's been a book written on all 320-some ways that you can prove one theorem. Talk about unity and diversity and all the different tasks you can use to do that. The proof of the infinitude of the prime numbers, the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, the fundamental theorem of algebra, fundamental theorem of calculus, all these are elegant theorems that reflect the poetry and rhyme of the mind. And so you have to have, someone has said you have to be a poet to really appreciate the theorems of mathematics. So there's a creational harmony, there's a unity and diversity. For example, pi, the ratio of the circumference of these, the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle, is found in, can be calculated by using an infinite power series, and it appears strangely in probability theory, an example of unity and diversity. E, the base of the natural logarithms, comes from the, from interest compounded continually, and it has a stunning interconnection in advanced mathematics. I, the square root of negative 1, we saw how it applies to quantum mechanics. Also, it's very essential in the theory of current, alternating current electricity, and also it is reflected in the beauties of fractal geometry. This is the picture of a complex number and its solutions as you rotate, apply rotations to complex numbers. It's called the Mandelbrot set. That's, and of course, there's an infinity to this, because if you zoom in to one section, the patterns continue. And zoom in and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, because when you start multiplying complex numbers by the same number, an infinite number of times, you have this recurrence like that. So we create this beautiful art out of square root negative one. First theorized in the early 20th century. Of course, at that point in time, computers didn't exist. Now we have computers. Now we have the processors. We can now plug in the numbers and perform the iterations, and we get this beautiful artwork. And this is even on T-shirts. So you should have had one of these on the back of our T-shirts for the conference in honor of geometry and mathematics. I could talk about that. This is a stunning equation proved by Euler. And I always end my pre-calculus classes with the proof of this. It takes about 35 steps to go through and prove this wonderful equation. How about that? E, the base of the natural logarithms, raised to the power of I, square root of negative 1, times pi, plus 1, equals 0. How about that? It can be proven. And high school students should be able to follow it. And I've proven that several times by actually doing the proof. Leonard Euler is the one who proved it originally. So that's a stunning interconnection, isn't it? E, the base of the natural logarithms. E, square root of negative 1, pi, geometry, addition, plus 1 and 0, basic numbers that are foundational to mathematics. All these diversities can be in one unity. So that's just absolutely amazing. So I could have chosen to do that. That would have been fun. Would have taken about 2 hours to go through. But the source of this creational harmony is the person of Christ. He's the source, as we talked about, the source of rationality, the source of all this interconnected wonder of creation that we find. In him, all things interconnect. The wholeness of harmony is found in the person of Christ. And this is the summation of Kepler's ethos, that harmony that motivated him to respond in worship unto God. So what I really want to do for the rest of the time we have, the 45 minutes, is that I want to explore one aspect of this creational harmony that captures its essence. It's called the golden ratio. We had a question about that last night, so you must have known I was going to talk about this, whoever had that question. All right, and so let's start. by analyzing the golden ratio to see what it is. It comes from the ancient Greeks, and the ancient Greeks had this passion for harmony and proportion, although it was not in the biblical Christian context. It was as a result of common grace that they discovered some of these things. And so this rectangle, they found that of all rectangles that are placed in front of you, there is a rectangle that has a proportion that's indicated in this arrangement that is the most pleasing to the eye. And the Greeks discovered this ratio. It's called the golden ratio. And because of this, they purposely constructed all of their buildings with that ratio in mind. The Parthenon is constructed, you look at all the rectangles in it, it has this ratio of the height to the base. And so what is the golden ratio? Well, let's take a look at it. Right now it's going to be entirely slides. It's the ratio of the base to the height is about 1.618. Okay, that's the approximate decimal expansion of this of the golden ratio. Accurately, precisely, exactly, it's 1 plus square root 5 divided by 2. We're going to show why we get that. All right, so are we ready for some math to keep us awake? Yeah, okay, are you ready? All right, okay. Sometimes this ratio is referred to as the extreme to the mean ratio. By that, we mean this, okay? Extreme to the mean, and the Greeks used the letter phi to represent that ratio, and this is what we mean. Given a line segment up on top, the length of the line segment as indicated is a plus b, and we take the line segment and we choose a length of a and a length of b so that we have this reality. The ratio of the whole line segment to the larger side, a plus b to a, is equal, if we set that ratio equal to the ratio of the longer side to the smaller side, a over b, when those two ratios are equal, we have that they represent the golden ratio of phi. That's the extreme to mean ratio. All right, so what we're going to do, we're going to look at that equation at the bottom, and now it's C, and we're facing it right there, and we're going to do some arithmetic and algebra with it. So let's see if we can follow what's going on. Okay, we know that A over B is going to be the golden ratio, and so what I've done there, I've solved that equation for A. I've multiplied both sides by B. So A is equal to B times phi. And now what I've done is I've gone and taken that equation and replaced in this ratio right up here. Wherever I see A, I'm going to replace it by B times phi. So there's my B times phi plus B all over B times phi. So I've changed this one to that one. And of course, what I've done, I've also replaced A with B times phi. And now I have B times phi over B. So what I've done is I got rid of the A by doing that. And now I have an expression or a proportion that's just in B and theta, and now I'm going to work with that. Everybody still with me? All right. Good review from algebra. All right. Now what I've done to go from here to there, is I've looked at the numerator here and I factored out the B. B times the quantity 5 plus 1. And now I can factor out the B in the numerator with the B in the denominator. Also, I can factor out this B with this B, and guess what I have? The B's gone. And now I have this. Everyone with me that so far? And now I'm going to solve for phi. What number, what value of phi makes this equation true? And then we'll discover the 1 plus square root 5 over 2 by doing this. So let's proceed with this. What I'm going to do next is I'm going to go ahead and get rid of the fraction right here and multiply both sides of that equation by phi. So I have 5 plus 1 equals 5 squared. And this ought to look familiar. What do I have, class? It's a quadratic equation. All right, 5 squared minus 5. So what did I do? I just got everything on the left-hand side of the equation, subtracted 5 from both sides, and subtracted 1 from both sides. So I have this quadratic equation equals 0. Well, the value of 5 makes this true. It's a quadratic equation. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to apply the infamous quadratic formula. X equals minus b plus minus square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. All right. And what's a? A equals 1. Coefficient of the phi squared term is 1. Coefficient of the phi term is minus 1. Coefficient of the constant is minus 1. All I have to do is plug in the numbers and see what's happening. 1 plus or minus the square root of 1 minus 4 times minus 1. Well, negative 4 times minus 1 is minus 4, and the opposite of that is plus 4, so there's my result. Phi is equal to 1 plus or minus square root 5 over 2. And if I actually approximate the decimal approximation, there's my 1.618. That's my ratio. When I look at the positive value, there's two solutions. If I take 1 minus square root of 5 over 2, I get negative 0.618. But we're looking at distances, okay? So that we drop off a negative. But don't forget this don't forget this number 618, 0.618, because it's going to come back. All right, now, from that, we've established the golden ratio. Now I'm going to look at something entirely different, a diversity that's nowhere connected to this. We've established this. Now I'm going to look at this very, very famous sequence of numbers. And those of you who are aware of this sequence, what is it?
Fibonacci
sequence, okay? And it's got a real cool pattern to it. You see the pattern? I start with the numbers 1, 1, my first two terms in the sequence. Add those two together, I get 2. Add 1 plus 2 gives me 3. 2 plus 3 is 5. 3 plus 5 is 8. Very simple sequence. And counting, addition, etc. There's the pattern. Okay. 1 plus 1 is 2. 1 plus 2 is 3. 2 plus 3 is 5. 3 plus 5 is 8. 5 plus 8 is 13. 8 plus 13, 21, etc. Ad infinitum without end. Keeps on going. The dot, dot, dot. The ellipses. So it's named after the famous Italian mathematician Leonardo Fibonacci, who introduced the Hindu-Arabic system of numbers, the positional notation, to Europe in the 13th century. He also introduced the work of the Arabic mathematician Al-Khwarizmi. He wrote a book that had in its title Algebra, from which we get the word algebra. So Fibonacci introduced that to the Christian Europe in the 13th century. He discovered this sequence by studying the population of rabbits and the genealogy of bees, totally, you know, and how they populate themselves if they don't die. All right, we're not going to go into the details behind that, but so also these numbers appear in the multiplicity of creational connections. If you count the seeds of a daisy head, the pine cone spirals, pineapple scales, seeds of a sunflower. For example, if we look at, this is the top view of a pine cone. And if I count the spirals, you have to remember where you started from, going one way, see that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. See the spirals going one way? And then you count the spirals going the other way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 and 8. Those are Fibonacci numbers. Did you follow that? I'm not going to do it again because I have more to cover. Try it with this one. You'll get lost. You got to really remember where you start. But again, the numbers, you see the two spirals going one way or the other? And those numbers will always be Fibonacci numbers. So here we have those Fibonaccis occurring in just a whole host of flowery examples. And a whole host. In fact, in the early 60s, a journal was established. It's called the Fibonacci Quarterly. It comes out every 4 times a year, and it's entirely devoted to how the Fibonacci sequence, these Fibonacci numbers, occur in a host of creational applications. And you can find websites that go into this in much, much more detail. So this is just an amazing, you know, creational connection in my humble opinion. So let's take a look. Let's ask a question now about the sequence. Take a look at the numbers. I've added a few more. No, I've got them up, going up to 233. Let's let the symbol F sub n represent the nth term of the sequence. Okay? So 1, that's the first term, F sub 1, F sub 2, F sub 3, F sub 4, So we're just labeling the terms, all right? So that's the nth term of the sequence. What happens to the ratio? What happens when I divide 1 divided by 1? What happens when I divide 2 divided by 1, 3 divided by 2, 5 divided by 3, 8 divided by 5, 13 divided by 8, etc.? See, that's what we're saying here. What happens to this ratio as I keep on going to infinity, as n gets larger and larger and larger? What's happening to the value of that ratio? Well, here's what's happening to it. Okay? When n equals 1, all right? Look what's happening to the ratio.
Ooh.
Have we seen that number before? 1.618. The golden ratio is found in the Fibonacci sequence. Again, that's a diversity in and a unity in that diversity. So we can state this, those of you who are familiar with calculus, it says this as the limit as the number of terms approaches infinity of this ratio approximates 5. I can also look at the reciprocal of that ratio, which is this, and I get 0.618, which is 1 over 5. It's amazing. This number has just got some connections that beat 60. So the other solution to the quadratic equation appears here when we look at the Fibonacci sequence. Okay, Kepler said this about that ratio. He says, geometry has two great treasures. One is the theorem of Pythagoras, and we'll talk about that shortly. We'll actually use it. The other, the division of a line into extreme and mean ratio. So when he said that, he meant what we just went through in terms of the ancient Greeks and calculation. The first we may compare to a measure of gold. The second we may name a precious jewel. So remember, it was Kepler who said when he was doing mathematics that he was thinking God's thoughts after him. So, what I want us to do now is we showed you the golden rectangle at the beginning of the section. And what I want to do is I want to show you how we can construct it using the tools that the ancient Greeks had at hand, a straight edge and a compass. All right, and what I've done here is I've actually taken a figure, the square, and I've, to make the calculations easier, I have made it a 2x2 square. It could be 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters or 2 inches by 2 inches, but I've put some dimensions on this. The ancient Greeks tended not to do that, tended not to want to put dimensions on their geometric figures for a philosophical reason, but we won't go into that. So I'm going to begin with a square. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to construct something over here that's going to be creating a rectangle that's going to be the golden rectangle, just by using simple constructions. So what am I going to do first? Okay, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to divide the square into two equal parts by what's called, firstly, if I have my compass, I take the top edge of the square, and I construct the bisector. I bisect that segment. Then I drop a perpendicular down. Actually, I'm constructing a perpendicular bisector, and I've not taken the time to do that, so I've done it for you already. And so, therefore, by doing that, I've got this distance here is 1, and that distance there is 1, by dividing that square into two equal parts. The next thing I want to do is I want to draw a diagonal. The diagonal there is in red. And I'm going to use that diagonal as the radius of a circle. Now, why is the length of that diagonal square root 5? Well, we know that by the Pythagorean theorem, because I have now a right triangle, right? And I know that this side, which is c squared, is by the Pythagorean theorem, is the length of this side, a squared, plus the length of this side, b squared. So the length of this side is 1, and I square it, that's 1 squared. The length of this side is 2, so I square that, it's 2 squared. So 1 squared plus 2 squared is 1 plus 4, which is 5. And, of course, the length of that diagonal is the square root of 5, and there's a justification to calculate that length. And now what I'm going to do with my compass, my invisible compass, is put it there on the screen. And, oh, first of all, I'm going to extend the baseline to give me some extra length, and then there's my compass. OK, And what I've done is I've drawn an arc of a circle, starting right here, and then connecting the point right here, because that's my radius. All right, so if this distance here is the square root of 5, that's my radius, and so the arc of the circle connects my extended line right there, I know that this entire distance has to be what? Square root 5. So if this distance is 1, this distance has to be square root 5 minus 1. Everybody still with me? Okay? So I've done that. And the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to now complete the triangle, which is golden. I'm going to extend the top side out and then drop a perpendicular, or actually what I'm going to be doing with my compass. At this point, I'm going to create a perpendicular line to this line, to that point, up and meet that line right up there. All right? And that is the golden rectangle. All right? And the ratio of the base to the height will be 5. Let's take a look at the ratio. Okay? The length, all right? The length of the rectangle, which is right here, all right? So this length here is 2, right? So I want to add 2 plus square root 5 minus 1, so I get 1 plus square root 5, right? For my numerator, that's my ratio of the length to the width. My width is 2, and there's my 5 that we just derived from the extreme mean ratio. So that's proving that that I have indeed constructed the golden rectangle, and those ratios are as indicated. Also, it can be shown to a fairly close accuracy that the ratio of the length from my chin to the top of my head, take that ratio and measure that, and then measure ear to ear, that's the golden ratio. Okay? For most people. Now, we're not done yet with this one. Let's take a look at this rectangle right here. This rectangle turns out to be a golden rectangle also. So we have a golden rectangle within a rectangle. So why is that? Okay? Huh? What happened there? I went over, all right, so it's square root 5 over minus 1 as the this length right here, excuse me, and then I've got my 2, so I take my ratio is 2 over square root 5 minus 1. Now, that's also equal to 1.618. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you why it is equal to 1.618 without actually doing the calculation. Okay? So this is going to be some algebra here. So we've got a golden rectangle within a golden rectangle. Excuse me for the extra red part there. Thought I had that one fixed. And so what I want to do is I'm going to show you that 2 over square root 5 minus 1 is actually equal to 1 plus square root 5 over 2. All right, so this ratio here, I'm going to show that ratio is the same as this one. Okay, how am I going to do that? All I'm going to do is, if you remember your algebra, look at we're going to basically get rid of the square root in the denominator right here. And so to get rid of that square root, we're going to multiply both the numerator and denominator by what's called the conjugate of the denominator, which is square root 5 plus 1. And so when I do that, I've got in my denominator, I've got square root 5 minus 1 times the quantity square root 5 plus 1. And I apply an algebraic identity, that's the difference of two squares, it becomes 5 minus 1, or 4. All right? So there's the 5 minus 1 in the numerator. 2 times the quantity of square root 5 plus 1, and so I've got denominator becomes 4, I can cancel the 2 and the 4, and guess what? Proved it. Without having to actually do the calculator to actually show it, which you could do. Okay? So that's just an introduction to some of the amazing wonders of the golden rectangle. And let's show something else now, another connection. We're going to start with the golden rectangle, as indicated there. Of course, we construct the golden rectangle by starting with a square. So there's the square that I'm starting with. And so, this is going to be a 1 by 1. That's going to be my first square. And then I actually create the other rectangle. So what I have here is this rectangle here is golden, and then this rectangle here is golden in terms of its ratio. And now what I'm going to do next is I'm going to build this, put this square onto it. All right? And now this rectangle is golden. And this one also is golden. So I have all these golden rectangles. Then I'm going to build another square on the base. So this entire rectangle is golden. This rectangle is golden. That one's golden. That one's golden. You have all these golden rectangles. And then I'm going to continue with the fourth square and build the square number 5 and build square number 6. And I could go ahead and build square number 7, but I don't have enough room. And now what I'm going to do, I'm going to look at the first square that I constructed. I'm going to take my compass, and I'm going to draw, put my compass point right there, and draw a quarter of a circle on that square. And then I'm going to take my compass point right here, draw a quarter of a circle, start my compass point right there, and do another quarter of a circle, continue the process, and what do I see? You end up with the perfection and wondrous beauty of what is mathematicians call the logarithmic spiral. Coming out of the construction of the golden rectangle, and of course this is another stunning interconnect. Let's talk a little bit more about that spiral. There, I've got it for you. And it's set up. I've labeled some of my points there, my vertices A, C, D, and B. Now, the center point of the logarithmic spiral is calculated by doing this. First of all, we draw the diagonals, the line segment AB, and then I draw the line segment CD. Okay, of course, the intersection between A and B, I'm noting that intersection as M, right there. Then I draw the diagonal CD, and then I note the intersection N. And, of course, the intersection of those two diagonals is right there at point O. All right, that's called the center point of the logarithmic spiral. And when you put this into the context of polar coordinates, that becomes the pole. All right, now, what's amazing about this, I'm not going to take the time to calculate this, but the ratio of AM to MB is going to be a golden ratio, and the ratio of CN to ND is also the golden ratio. So constructing the center point reveals the golden ratio in two other aspects. Again, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could give you a multiplicity of slides that go into a lot more. All right. Now here's another marvelous unity and diversity. So now what I've got my golden rectangles all constructed, and I've got my spiral there, and I've got the center of the spiral. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to choose a point, J, on the spiral itself. Choose that point, J. I'm going to connect a line segment from the center point, the pole, to point J. So I have my line segment OJ. And I'm going to measure the angle there. What I've also done is through point J, I've constructed a line that's tangent to the spiral at that point. And then I'm identifying the angle alpha as the angle from that line to line JO, and here's my other angle beta. So if I choose that point J, I have those two angles. Now I can choose any other point on the logarithmic spiral and do the same thing. And I've chosen a point K, and I've drawn the tangent line to the curve through point J. And then I've connected point K to point O, and I go ahead and measure. That angle is going to be the same angle. The measure of alpha is going to be the same, no matter what point I choose. So that's another amazing connection. And that's why this spiral was also called the equal angular spiral. So the logarithmic spiral and the equal angular spiral are named for that primary reason. So again, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what you can do with this. I can put this into the polar form and do some more work with it too and give you the polar form equation, but I'm not going to do that. Okay? And you can create with complex numbers the same spiral using complex numbers. This is a complex number that I've created using my software, and I've performed an iteration on it, a specific type of iteration. And this is the result of this is the solution set, you might call, of this iteration on that complex number. And so what I've done is I've been able to generate the logarithmic spiral using complex numbers. Talk about another unity revealed in another diverse application. So this is almost endless in terms of these connections. And of course, this is how I started the presentation yesterday. Is there I have the chambered nautilus, a cross-section of the chambered nautilus. So take a good look at the curve. This is the logarithmic spiral in God's creation. Perfect. That is, you couldn't get any more perfect than that in terms of the shape. So note in this case how mathematics confirms exactly. This is not just a model. We are actually following how God organized the chambered nautilus to grow, and its growth pattern reflects the logarithmic spiral. So what we have done, we are thinking God's creative thoughts after him by this process of reasoning. And our results conform exactly with the handiwork of God. So wouldn't you have liked to have math taught this way? I would have liked to have math taught this way when I was your age. And so this is what you can do, and this is what you can see. So, conclusion. Man can think mathematically, and the physical creation reflects mathematical patterns because of a common creator. We were able, with our thought processes, to do all these derivations and do the algebra and do the quadratic formulas that normally bore students to death, because the context is never given for quadratics anyhow. Of course, the context for quadratics, remember I talked about the conic sections of the ellipse. Remember that? When we talked about Kepler. I've been getting Kepler and Kuiper confused because they both start with K. When you get past 50, you do start doing that. Okay? Your brain starts, the synapses start, failing. So anyhow, so we talked about the ellipse. Now, another conic section is called the parabola. And another one is called a hyperbola. Of course, we have the circle is also the fourth conic section. All those, when we park those figures, those pictures, those diagrams, the ellipse, the hyperbola, and the parabola and the circle, into the Cartesian coordinate plane, we get equations that are quadratic. And of course, we've seen how the ellipse describes the planetary orbits, and a quadratic equation can be applied to that, and that's what Kepler was doing to analyze what was going on. Parabola is a perfect graph to reflect free fall motion and projectile motion. So Galileo was using quadratics. Newton was using quadratics to analyze free fall motion, projectile motion in physics. And the hyperbola also is used in motion. Sonic booms, when you have an airplane flying past the speed of sound, produces a boom pattern in front of it. And the curve of the boom pattern so you're standing over here and the airplane's coming above you and you hear the boom at a certain point because the sound waves have this kind of shape, and that shapes the hyperbola as the sound waves intersect with the earth, and it moves in this direction. So I'm hearing the sonic boom when I'm standing here, but over here the gentleman over there is hearing it when he's over there because he's on the curve. So you hear it first. And I have to wait to hear it. Okay? Just a few microseconds, if this is actual that distance. The hyperbola connects to the physical creation. The ancient Greeks had no clue that these types of figures, two-dimensional figures, would have that type of application 2,000 years later. And this happens quite a bit in mathematics. A mathematician develops and derives something, and it kind of sits there in hibernation until God's providence is there to move upon a mathematician like Kepler or Newton or Galileo And now, as a result of that, we have the scientific revolution. We have all the technology we have today. We couldn't build Boeing 747s. What's the latest one, the 780? You know, the big one, the Dreamliner. You can't build those airplanes without a knowledge of the Cartesian coordinate system, without a knowledge of the quadratics, without a knowledge of calculus developed by Newton. So we have these wonderful results from the technology. Okay, so the conclusion here is that mathematics is indeed a unique tool of wonder. I could have, and if I had more time, I would walk through the rainbow with you. That would be interesting. All the trig and the geometry involved with the rainbow to help you understand a little bit better of the wonders of God's creation. So it's a tool. As a tool by itself, okay, toolbox, carpenter toolbox. Your dad has toolboxes, doesn't he? Just look at the tools, hammer, screwdriver, Phillips, you know, pliers, whatever. It's not too beautiful, isn't it? But in the hands of a master carpenter, what can a carpenter do with those tools? He can build, as we learned earlier this morning, tables, chairs, homes, you name it. Can build some beautiful things. So mathematics is a tool. So the algebra that you're learning is a tool. By itself, it's just a hammer, not too pretty. But when you take the hammer and you start building things with it, as we've seen today, you see the wonder that can result from it. So you got to have the context of taking the tool to build it. And history and science help you to make those applications. So studying mathematics in a biblical Christian way will lead us to a better worship and adore our faithful and covenant-keeping God, because without his covenant, none of us would hold together. We could not make any of these derivations. We could not make any of these conclusions. We could not see the wonder that God has put into the world. So the wonder is, like I said earlier, is like a treasure. And so God says, it's the glory of God to hide and conceal a matter. It's the glory of kings to search out a matter. And all of wisdom and knowledge that exists is hidden in the person of Christ, who holds all of this together as the sustainer of all of created reality, both visible and invisible. So that's my conclusion, and I get to get you guys off early, 15 minutes. Okay, thank you.